The Takeaway is supported by Netflix original documentary series Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On, from Rashida Jones, Jill Bauer, and Ronna Gratis. The series explores sex and technology in a digital age. Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On is now streaming only on Netflix.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. 99 days of Trump, 100 days of Trump. We're there one day more. Does the president wish he had 500 days of summer or more of this honeymoon to start his administration? Regardless, the 100 days is a measure that places President Trump up alongside other administrations as well as his own promises. A recent survey by the University of Virginia Center of Politics shows that 93% of Trump voters approve of the job he's doing. Generally, his approval rating is down in the 40s. That job is a mix of scandal, Flynn and the Russian allegations, actions seen as successful executive orders that stuck, military strikes in Syria and Afghanistan, a successful Supreme Court justice nominee, an appointment, but no withdrawal from NAFTA, no wall, no repeal of Obamacare, and an immigration initiative stalled in the courts. How are Trump voters feeling about his first 100 days? Well, Cheryl St. Germain is a former restaurant owner who now lives in Marco Island, Florida, and was on our program on Inauguration Day, as was Kevin Loney, a salesman from Manchester, New Hampshire. For both, it's been 100 days of thoughtful, tentative progress, and Cheryl starts us off.
I'm feeling good about him. I feel that our president Trump has made a lot of good decisions. I'm pleased with the Supreme Court justice. I feel he's out there supporting small businesses. I like the Keystone Pipeline direction. Of course, there have been some embarrassing moments and things not thought out, like the travel ban was awful. But he's not perfect, and we have to give him time.
Kevin, how about you? How's your 100 days in Manchester, New Hampshire?
Oh, they're great, John. I, too, am pretty excited. I feel like I got the guy I voted for. He's exactly how I thought he would be. No filter. You know, he doesn't fit the mold. He's trying to run it like a business. I'm with Cheryl that, you know, a couple of these toe stubs are embarrassing, but that's going to happen when you have almost a rookie in there, but he's trying to run it like a business. The one thing that I like is he's making changes as he goes. And if you have a business plan, once you start to enact that, you have to make changes as the facts on the street change. You know, everyone says, oh my gosh, he pulled back from China, currency manipulation. Okay, but he threw that up as a trial balloon. The Chinese guy came to Florida, and then a day later, China announced the embargo against American beef was gone, and they were opening up the financial markets to us. Same thing with the wall. He pulls back from the wall. Why? Because Canada and Mexico called him, because they know he's not bluffing. So I'm very happy. I'm glad to see the Supreme Court guy. And we have to give him a change. I want the Democrats to step it up, though. Come on, reach your hands across. And we have to. I think President Trump has to work harder across the table, get more people, find out what they want to get in the deal.
To both of you, I'm going to tick off a couple of things and just get your impressions of where things are headed. Cheryl and Kevin, and Cheryl, you begin. North Korea, worried?
Concerned.
Donald Trump able to handle North Korea? Are you concerned, Kevin?
No, not at all.
Not at all. All right.
Not at all.
How about the economy? Worried or feeling just fine about it? Cheryl?
I'm feeling our president's an overachiever, and he is going to have a handle on that. Feel good about that.
Kevin, how about the economy?
Oh, awesome. 2016 was one of the worst business years for me until the day after the election. And I did more quotations in the month of December than ever before. And so far in 2017, I'm maybe 30% over my goal.
That's a pretty good 100 days there, Kevin.
Yeah. I mean, I made 40 calls last month, and I have to say 30 of them were just booming. Happy, glad he was there. Real sense of things are starting to change. And when you walk into a factory, you can tell if it's got life, if it's got, you know, a vibrant sound to it. And 30 out of 45 is a pretty good number.
Cheryl, climate change. How about that? I mean, you're on an island there in Florida.
Lucky me. It is probably something I'm not worried about.
A little worried, though.
A little worried?
Yeah, I hear it. Kevin, how about you?
Yeah, I'm a little worried because I don't know enough about it. And some of the big words and the terms and all the data doesn't make sense to me. And I haven't spent time on it. It's a low priority for me. There are other things we need to fix.
Russia.
Ouch. That's concern.
Kevin.
Yeah, I'm concerned too. At first, I was hoping to see another trial balloon go up and he would address something. Now it's kind of gone to the back burner because of North Korea, but we know they're playing around in Syria and it's going to come back to bite us, I think.
Let's finish it up on healthcare. Cheryl?
Healthcare, I feel that he came out too fast, too strong, unorganized. It's going to take a whole lot longer than 100 days to figure that one out. However, he's listening and he is going to have the right people. Might be January, might be down the road, but that's going to get better than it has been. It's positive.
All right, Kevin, take it to the goalpost.
Yeah, this is one where he came out way too soon. Anyone who expected him to do that in 100 days, a fool. But he's going to take the gloves off.
Were you one of the people who expected him to do that in 100 days?
Absolutely not. I knew that was just election rhetoric. But here's the deal. We have to stop leaning left and leaning right on this. There were some good ideas in Obamacare, but there was some bad implementation, and the insurance companies still are getting away with murder. The pre-existing condition, that's got to stay. So what we have to do is come to the table and say, bring what you definitely want, what you need, and then you got to bring some bargaining chips to give away. Let's do this logical and do it right, not along party lines.
Cheryl St. Germain, former restaurant owner who now lives in Marco Island, Florida, and just speaking there, Kevin Loney, who's a salesman from Manchester, New Hampshire. Thanks to both of you for your candor on this Friday.
Oh, great, John. I love your show and always love talking to you.
Go Trump.
Have fun and watch the water level down there in Marco Island.
Thank you. I've got it covered.
Stomping for the Trump man once again.
That was the spirit way back during the campaign when Craig Moss from Oswego, New York, was playing at President Trump's rallies.
Jim Brown, that Trump train, roll on down the line.
We talked with an enthusiastic country singer, Craig Moss, back then, but the health care bill Republicans put forth weeks ago made Craig angry for its less than aggressive response to the opioid crisis, something that has affected him personally. His son died tragically 3 years ago. When we spoke to him, he said now he just can't stand behind the president he helped elect.
The night of the election, I went to bed early because I had no doubt in my mind that that then candidate Donald Trump was going to be the president the next morning. Sure enough, that's what happened. And I really didn't have any reason to be down at the time. Things were going fine. It seems like he started signing some executive orders, but I didn't support everything about what Donald Trump has said or done. I certainly never supported his making fun of the handicapped reporter or his deportation policies or his proposed ban on Muslims. But there were things that was very attractive to me, the helping out the veterans with their health care situation, and then the health care bill for the United States to attack this heroin epidemic that we find ourselves in. And that was most important to me. Then once I discovered that there was $5 billion going to be taken away from substance abuse programs and that children with complex medical needs were going to have to find a different outlet. And it was just a tragedy that, all of a sudden I realized that I had been lied to, that the American people had been lied to in regards to health care and what he planned on doing with the heroin epidemic, which was to decrease deductions, decrease the overall cost, and increase the amount of services available for substance abuse patients. And I'd realized at that point that we'd all been shuffled aside. And, although the little people were important to him during his campaign, Donald Trump became President Donald Trump. It seems as though he didn't quite reach out to the people. And it was very, very disappointing.
Now, you're not a supporter then anymore. You're hurt. Your son died of a heroin overdose 3 years ago. You were a part of the campaign. You certainly invested your heart into the campaign. What else did you invest?
Well, I invested financially. I stopped making mortgage payments, which I did freely but not wisely on my home. It's now in foreclosure, and I'm scurrying around trying to get some carpet in it so I can sell it and recoup some monies. I sold my backhoe, job trailers, small equipments, everything I owned that I could turn into cash to help fund myself and support myself on the road. I followed him around the countryside, 45 rallies and all, and with such emotion, I exerted so much emotion that, you know, my son's death was not in vain, that I go and I talk to the people in line about how great Donald Trump was and how his ideas are just so fantastic. When people come up to you, John, and they hug you after I've told my story about my son passing and how close we were and how he died from a heroin fentanyl overdose, when they whisper in your ear before they pull away and say, I lost my son two weeks ago, or we just lost our daughter, you know, a week ago to heroin, and we appreciate what you're doing. You know, it just gave me so much purpose, and it made the sacrifice so worth it. To have this happen and to have this backtrack and to have, you know, what I was following him and so excited about, and to be presented in the way that it did, it just brought to light that what people were telling me were true, and that is, he's not going to be able to deliver what he says he's going to. And so I sacrificed a tremendous amount over getting a president into this position.
Well, you're the guy right in the middle here, you know, Connor.
Well, and I am the guy right in the middle, and I look at it and I say, You know, he's been having a handful of problems. You know, he's trying to throw this a travel ban. It didn't stick a couple times. He tried to put that through, and his first effort to try to revamp the Veterans Affairs there just kind of fell to the wayside. But on the bright side of the thing, as far as the health care plan goes and the heroin epidemic, he's got Chris Christie on a board of opiate task force. And what he does have going for him, Chris Christie I speak of, is a bill that he passed recently on opiates in New Jersey. It's a brilliant bill that addresses everything that I would like to see to be available in health care. And it provides 4 weeks of inpatient and 4 weeks of outpatient services for substance abuse without the doctor's prescription saying that it's a medical necessity. And then with that prescription of medical necessity, it offers 6 months outpatient and 6 months inpatient, you know, for a substance abuse person. So, and it also limits the amount of opioids that will be prescribed to 5 days, 5 day supply, I think, for the first two or three times. And then if they have then after that, I guess they can go to 30 days. But it requires doctors to be well educated before prescribing opioids. And it also requires that doctor to counsel and educate the patient before they accept that prescription and talk to them about alternate ways of pain relief. And with that, that's a fantastic bill, and I just certainly hope they could fold that into the new health care plan that they try to put forth.
Any more songs?
No, I'm not running out and writing songs against the president. Unlike many, I don't wish for President Trump to fail in his journey as president and his tasks that he has in front of him. If he wins, we all win. If he gets some of the things that he has talked about and promised during the campaign, if he gets some of those through, then we're all winners. I don't wish for him to fail in his efforts at all. I just don't support him. I wrote a song about my son. It's called Cherished Memories. And, you know, he wrote me birthday cards. And in the front of those cards, some of the words would be like, you know, my gift to you isn't anything that costs. It's a gift of memories that we will share. And I've used those words in the song that I put together for him.
Hide and seek and make believe he was cat and hook. Notching trees got shown me he's old, dead I need. And memories of thee.
You know, he would put a couple pictures inside the card that he made of he and I on a camping trip, or things that were dear to him and certainly dear to me. So no more songs for right now. I don't play any Trump songs. And certainly, you have to have it in your heart to play. And the only thing I really have emotion to play would be that song, Cherished Memories.
Craig Moss, thanks so much.
Hey, appreciate you having me on. It's good talking to you again, John.
Cherished memory.
Greg Moss is a country singer and former Trump supporter from upstate New York.
Cherished memory.
When is a war a permanent occupation? The 16-year-old American adventure in Afghanistan is looking increasingly like Korea without a demilitarized zone. Everywhere there are possible enemy fighters and possible casualties, apparently. The Afghan military has suffered stunning setbacks. This past weekend, a Taliban raid on an Afghan military base killed approximately 170 Afghan recruits. This week, two American service members were killed and a third wounded in a counterinsurgency raid against not the Taliban, but ISIS in Nangarhar province. A Green Beret killed in Aachen earlier this month was the first U.S. casualty in quite some time, and that death became the rationale for the U.S. dropping its biggest non-nuclear bomb in Afghanistan. Carlotta Gall is the North Africa correspondent for the New York Times and recently traveled to the country. She's author of The Wrong Enemy, America in Afghanistan, 2001 to 2014, and she joins me now. Carlotta, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Carlotta, I'm surprised that ISIS is part of the mission in Afghanistan. Does this represent some kind of mission creep, or has it always been the case?
It's an expansion and a morphing of the same old problem. This is a Taliban group, a Pakistani Taliban group, that's now taken up the flag of ISIS. They've had connections with Syria, and they've got money from them. But they're really doing it to just be the biggest, baddest group in the region. And it's a progression of the same problem we've had, as you say, for 16 years in Afghanistan.
So this 800 or so militants may have been, or probably were, Taliban, you say, and they just got a ISIS membership card, picked up a flag, and all of a sudden the mission seems to shift in Afghanistan, and we're dropping huge non-nuclear bombs.
Well, the big bomb is proof that they're still there. We've still got this persistent problem. And the bomb was used to try and save lives, because the American Special Forces and Afghan Special Forces trying to remove this group were coming up against real resistance. They were dug into caves and tunnels in the hillside. And so that bomb was used as the most effective way to save lives and to eliminate this group. We then had two more casualties, which shows that there's still others there, and it's still a very tough fight. It just shows you how difficult it is and how persistent the problem is.
And in this particular case, the raid this week that killed two American service members, what kind of tactics were seen there, and are they fundamentally different than anything we've seen in the last 16 years?
I think it's the same as certainly a lot of us have seen. You know, they're perhaps more ruthless, ISIS, because they want to get the headlines. But they're essentially guerrilla forces that are fighting, but to a very high level, because they're fighting special forces. They're using the terrain. They're using, you know, weapon systems. We are hearing they're getting more and more sophisticated things, like night vision and increasingly more sophisticated explosives. But in the end, they're doing what they've always been doing, which is ambushing and trying to kill Americans to show that they're still there and they're still strong.
The dropping of the MOAB, non-nuclear bomb, earlier this month was condemned by former President Karzai. What does the Afghan government say about the state of fighting right now and the vulnerability, apparently, of Afghan forces who suffered this huge setback of 170 recruits killed earlier this week, actually over the weekend?
Well, it's interesting. I was in Afghanistan when that bomb was dropped, and I was in one of the provinces with officials from the Ghani government people who've been fighting the Taliban for 16 years. They actually were relieved to have this bomb. They felt it showed that America was still engaged. It gave morale to the Afghan forces that they've still got American support in a big way. And so, of course, from the government side, although President Karzai criticized it, and it was shocking to many because of its size and the fact that you're still 16 years later throwing really huge bombs on those mountains, because, of course, that's where bin Laden was for his last stand and where the Daisy Cutter bombs were dropped in 2001. So there was shock and horror, but actually there was some relief in certainly the people who are with the government and the security forces, because they felt this shows that America is still serious and is still on our side.
Carlotta Gall, does that relief translate into an expectation that the Trump administration is going to enlarge the mission in Afghanistan and
give us many more years and a lot more fighting against Taliban and now ISIS.
I think there's great concern in Afghanistan as to what the Trump administration is going to do. We know they were there recently. Officials were doing a review. And I think, of course, the Afghans are worried that this is just a one-off. They then had, obviously, the devastating attack on their base, as you mentioned, in the north, where they lost nearly 200 people. So I think there's a concern that, was it just a show? There's also this sneaking feeling among the Afghans that sort of bomb shows the Americans have got the wherewithal. They could do it, but why don't they come in and do it properly, do it skillfully with the pressure on Pakistan as well and the diplomacy that's needed as well as the firepower. So I think there's great concerns that another administration is not going to go the whole way or get it right, the right balance. Of course, Afghans don't want more bombs that kill more people. They want a solution that ends the war as well.
Coletta Gall is North Africa correspondent for The New York Times and author of The Wrong Enemy, American Afghanistan, 2001 to 2014. Carlotta, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
The Takeaway is supported by Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On, a Netflix original documentary series from Rashida Jones, Jill Bauer, and Ronna Gratis, the women who brought you the critically acclaimed film Hot Girls Wanted. The series explores the intersection of sex and technology in a digital age and covers six true stories inside a world that is faking it. A 2017 Sundance Film Festival official selection, Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On is now streaming only on Netflix.
Earlier this week, ESPN laid off 100 journalists and on-air personalities, Trent Dilfer, Len Elmore, and Jason Stark, among others. It's a signal that the gravy train at ESPN may have found the caboose. SportsCenter is not the center of the sports universe anymore. Fans are turning to smartphones, tablets, and mobile services that follow consumers instead of cable for updates, highlights, and games. ESPN, did you know this, has lost more than 10 million subscribers over the past several years, while the cost of broadcasting Major League Sports is only going up. Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast, says that ESPN's latest move is unfortunate, but it reveals that networks that get paid by the sports leagues ultimately can't be relied on for the journalism that holds the sports industry accountable.
I've talked to ESPN reporters who have told me stories about having articles spiked that they were putting together that were seen as being too critical of the leagues. I've had other ESPN reporters tell me stories about what they call the invisible censors. And that's this idea that nobody is telling them to spike stories, but there's this voice in their mind that says, wait a minute, you can only go so far. Even though there is this vaunted wall between the journalism side and the entertainment side, when that wall gets breached to the degree that it did with these layoffs, I mean, it removes even the slightest cover by the journalists who are left to do this kind of work critically. But the conflict of interest is baked into the cake at a place like ESPN.
Armin Katayan, who's a network reporter and who's spent years trying to do this and fighting these battles, probably thinks this is a pretty old story.
Absolutely. And I could see people like Armin Katayan saying that. But my concern about this is that it's a change in terms of quantity, not merely quality. And when you see really good journalists being treated like they're part of the gig economy, part of the service industry, part of the wave that's being largely underreported of the tens of thousands of retail workers who've been laid off in this country over the last 6 months, I think it really does have this seismic cultural effect where people feel like, wow, no job is really safe and no job is valued in this country right now.
Are we headed to a situation where the league's networks basically control the landscape and everybody else has to take little pieces of it, and Lord knows where the games end up?
Yeah, we are headed in that direction. I mean, NFL Network, NBA, MLB, and they've actually done a very interesting thing of going after some of the best reporters who are laid off by newspapers, and then they're effectively hired directly by the networks that are effectively the sports leagues. And that, of course, is a disturbing development, even like beyond issues like, say, in the NFL head injuries. Like, what do they do when there's an actual strike or a lockout? What kind of reporting do you get if those become the primary places where people go for news? I mean, and you see...
And the paycheck that the reporter gets comes from the same place that the player gets.
Yeah, but I always get concerned that this then becomes a stalking horse for how regular news will be done in the future. And I've thought about that, you know, with things like, you know, billion-dollar stadium deals and this idea where public money gets to turn into private profit for sports owners, and how that, you know, laid the groundwork in the 1990s for the Wall Street bailouts, for example. And I think that in journalism, the fear is that this becomes a stalking horse for that development as well.
Maybe all of the business model goes the way of boxing, where it's just direct to consumer, pay per view, and the leagues get the money directly, and there may not be any ESPN or non-affiliated network broadcasting games.
Yeah, but you see the great diminishing of cultural capital when it comes to sports. And there was a time when boxing was part of the national discussion. That doesn't exist anymore. And sports are still in this country an instrument of community cohesion. But when everything becomes pay-per-view and you have this widening gap in wealth, what you lose is that idea of sports being a connective tissue in this country.
Dave Zirin is sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Thanks so much, Dave.
Thank you, John.
So you can have complete control.
Well, that was easy.
Yeah, I guess it was.
Gigabyte of RAM should do the trick. We're in. All right, what do we got?
Wow. Excellent.
We fixed the glitch.
I've lost the bleeps, I've lost the sweeps, and I've lost the creeps.
The what?
The what?
And the what?
No, the bleeps, the sweeps, and the creeps.
Yes, yes, it's Friday. That's right. As always, we talk with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Hey there, Rafer.
Hey, John.
So this is the time of year when interesting little films or even interesting big films get released. And we begin with The Circle, a Dave Eggers book.
That's right.
Tell me a little bit about it, and we'll play a clip.
This is about a young woman, Mae Holland, played by Emma Watson. She goes to work for this tech company called The Circle, led by Tom Hanks as Eamon Bailey. He's kind of a Steve Jobs type. His goal is to basically blanket the world with cameras and abolish privacy.
In the interest of sharing everything she can with the world, Mae has some news.
From now on, I'll be wearing a modified sea change camera at all times.
That's right. Mae will be the first Circle to share every single second of her work and her personal life with the public, so let's give her an even bigger hand.
So Circular is a big corporation, I suspect.
Yes.
And Emma Watson is not Harry Potter.
That's no, she's
American
not.
American voice.
No, she's doing her American voice here. She's just a pretty normal woman who goes to work for this place. It's one of these large sort of Silicon Valley campuses. She gets sucked into the lifestyle. It's this kind of enclosed enclave where they keep you on the premises as much as possible.
Lots to be interested in here.
I like this very interesting idea of privacy. If everybody were transparent, if everything were transparent, would that not be better for government? Would we maybe all behave better as a society if we knew that we were being watched all the time? That's a pretty interesting idea, and there is this sense that we're kind of getting there in some weird way. I just wish this film had a better storyline to go with it, something a little more exciting. I wish it felt more like a thriller or more like sci-fi or more like a drama, but it's somewhere hovering in between. The stakes seem kind of low, and in the end, I just didn't really think it works. It's kind of fun to see Tom Hanks in a quasi-villain role. That's kind of unusual and different, but I just felt it kind of fell flat ultimately.
Kind of 1985 and a half.
Well, you know what the problem is? We're kind of already there. So when you present a scenario like this, it doesn't give you that wow factor. You kind of feel like, oh, yeah, I mean, I sort of know what that's like to have my personal life be broadcast all the time. Isn't that what we're all already doing? So in a way, it doesn't look forward to the future enough or give us that kind of weird future feel.
There are about 2.5 million people listening to you right now. Nervous about that. Hanks and Watson performance is good, and let's move on.
Okay. Yeah, I would say we should move on to a movie called Slight, a very small movie that did well at Sundance, got picked up. It's about a young kid who is a street magician, and he can do some very amazing things. He can levitate objects with his hands.
There's a card in here with your name on it, right?
Uh-huh.
Let's say 51 of these cards are too scared to trust themselves, too afraid to believe that they can do whatever they want.
Okay.
You know, your card knows there's no wall, no limit, no barrier.
Okay.
Is that your card?
Oh, God.
No, it's
God.
No.
love that.
It's kind of interesting. Here's what the secret is. I'm not spoiling anything. The way he manages to do these tricks is that he has actually implanted his shoulder with an electromagnet that he learned how to build in high school. So that's why he's actually able to levitate metal objects. I like small movies. I like weird movies. But this premise is very small and very weird. And it just, the entire time I was watching this film, I just kept thinking, how is this possible? How did he implant that in his shoulder? Are you telling me that there are wires going down through his arms into his fingers that he can manipulate metal with? It just didn't make any sense to me.
All
and
right,
the whole film,
on.
I just couldn't wrap my head around it.
Movies that don't make sense? Come on.
I see your point.
Any new actors, though, in this movie that we should be paying attention to?
Dule Hill is in this movie from The West Wing. He plays one of the drug dealers, and it's nice to see him in this film. You know, I would like to see a little bit more from this director, because it does have a little bit of an interesting mood and a style to it, but this one, I'm afraid, just didn't work for me.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Have a great weekend.
Thanks. You too, John.
A verdict seen as a crime 25 years ago.
Not guilty, the verdict for all of them, Sergeant Stacy Kuhn, Officers Tim Wind, Lawrence Powell, Ted Versino. Not guilty of assault, not guilty of filing false reports. Only on one count against Lawrence Powell, on excessive use of force under color of authority, could the jury not agree. On that count, the judge declared a mistrial.
An acquittal for the officers seen on video beating handcuffed and unarmed motorist Rodney King in the first trial became the final provocation for the African-American community fed up with police violence in 1992. On the streets around the intersection of Florence and Normandy, enraged crowds rampaged for 6 days. There were more than 50 people killed, $1 billion in damages. What do those events mean today? And how would the people of today experience similar events as rioters, as victims, as police, as witnesses? John Ridley, Academy Award-winning screenwriter of 12 Years a Slave, addresses this question in his film Let It Fall, a documentary premiering tonight on ABC. Ridley peers through the images of tear gas to find a divided America that preceded the events and that persists to this day.
We're so used to seeing instant images now that for people under a certain age, I don't know that they can really understand two things. One, what it means to capture an outsized, whispered about. People had talked about this kind of police interaction before, but really had not been on tape. So you have two things. One, the capturing of that image, and not only that image. This was not one blow. This was not 10 blows. This was about 56 blows in about 80 seconds or so. So you're talking about a really outsized expression of a difficult police interaction. Then this is the early days of the 24-hour news cycle, cable news. So you're taking images that people had not seen before, and you're playing them over and over and over again. And in the early days of CNN, you know, initially, ironically, CNN had rejected the tape. It played on the local news. But once it played locally, everybody got it. It was playing not only in Los Angeles, not only across the country, but around the world.
One of the things that's striking about this film, you know, Let It Fall, is that, you know, you're telling a story of a whole decade, and there's a logic to that decade. And then when you see the images of people just exploding into stores, and the logic goes away, and it's terrifying to see.
Obviously, there are many things that people were feeling on that day, the day the verdict was read.
But the verdict that acquitted the officers,
the verdict that acquitted
in Simi Valley.
Four officers in Simi Valley, and basically a lot of people took that. After many events is saying, you know, if you're a person of color and you're assaulted on the color of authority, it does not matter. There is no recourse. So people felt many things that day, as I was saying, anger and rage and disbelief. But as someone, one of our subjects says, you know, the compassion line was just closed. It was a lack of empathy for other individuals, particularly individuals who were not black.
If you're going to shoot LaTosha Harlins in the back of the head for some orange juice and get probation, you're going to beat Rodney King 57 times with a stick and then somehow want to justify that. You're going to take a battering ram and decide that that's the way you need to get into homes in the black community. And what you're telling me is you have no respect for us.
And that was something that really came to a head at Florence and Normandy.
In that zone, even the police were terrified. And their leaving issued a kind of, okay, there are no rules now.
And that seemed to inflame the violence at Florence and Normandy. Do you believe that that's the case?
Well, I absolutely believe that's the case. There was a smaller interaction, very tense interaction, but a smaller one at 71st in Normandy. And a local police commander, an individual who had oversight of that division, made the decision to pull his officers out. His fear was if they remained, deadly force was either going to be used against the officers or the officers would have to use deadly force against the community.
It would become a shooting war.
Had I allowed my officers to begin to use deadly force at that intersection, God knows what that riot would have turned into. That riot could have been a riot of not just burning down buildings. It could have been a riot of just pure anarchy against the police, and not just against the police in Los Angeles, but against all police across America.
But in pulling his officers out, not just retreating a few blocks, but really pulling them out to a marshaling center, that left no officers. That left no sense of order. And at that point, again, as individuals who were there recount in our documentary, pouring gasoline on a fire, striking a match, and watching it just continue to burn.
The people you talked to who were right in that epicenter, who either were victims or were participants or who attempted to stand in between the people who wanted to commit violence and people who were powerless and just dragged from their cars, what surprised you most about what they told you?
I think what surprised me the most is that every decision to those individuals was a very human decision. They felt as though they had a reason to act the way they acted.
Everyone needs to feel the same pain in their schools, in their churches. You understand what I'm saying? The same anguish, the same heartache. They need to feel the same thing.
On the other end of the spectrum, people who made amazingly heroic decisions, selfless decisions, quite literally put their lives on the line, they didn't come across as though they felt as though they were superhuman. They felt this is something I had to do, and I could not live with myself if I did not go out and try to save these individuals.
Do you know which person you would have been? Would you have been the heroic? Would you have been the angry? Would you have been – is there a way to think about that?
I think ultimately I would have been the person that I was, because I had the emotions to the I will categorize them as being to the negative, being outrage and anger at the verdict. I certainly don't think that I would have been the person who would have just randomly attacked a person who was different from me because they were white or Asian or Hispanic. But at the same time, I don't think I would have had the capacity to necessarily go out in an intersection among individuals who clearly were not giving much empathy to other people and say, look, I got to do something. I've got to try to help. In the end, if anybody thought they were balancing the scales, you know, $1 billion in damage, you know, thousands of structures burned down, hundreds of people injured, 50, more than 50 dead, and the majority of them black, you know, nothing was squared. If anything should have been, absolutely nothing was.
That's John Ridley, Academy Award-winning screenwriter of 12 Years a Slave, showrunner for the ABC drama American Crime, and director of Let It Fall, Los Angeles 1982 to 1992, a documentary on the L.A. uprising that is premiering tonight on ABC at 9 p.m. Eastern. Filmmaker Sasha Jenkins' film, streaming now on Showtime, is a quite different look at the 1992 L.A. uprising. While John Ridley's film might be said to be tamed for the networks, Showtime is much less tame, and Jenkins' film might have been called Burn, Baby, Burn, but instead it's Burn, followed by the word mother. You can imagine the rest, Burn. That's part of the story, really. In 25 years, memories may have dimmed, but anger has perhaps intensified, or in 21st century media, we tend to equate uncensored speech with clarity. But do we have clarity? Sasha Jenkins says that clarity requires going back to the L.A. riots in Watts in 1965, sparked by the arrest of African-American motorist Marquette Frye. The parallels, he says, are striking, eerie, and suggest that whatever words we use, anger drives a deep frustration over inequality in Los Angeles even today. Unlike John Ridley, who lives in L.A. and conveys a certain affection in his film about his still vulnerable home,
Sasha Jenkins comes to this history after growing up in the East and has produced a documentary that aims, rightly or wrongly, to provoke from the title to the credits.
Obviously, folks were angry for the same reasons, but I think the intensity in 92 was heavier because it was a generation or two removed from the folks in 65. And so all the grievances and issues that weren't addressed in 65, here it is all over again in 92. And if you just put 65, the sequence of 1965 in my film right next to 1992, it's literally the same thing.
What are the two trigger points that cause you to believe there's a real parallel here?
Well, there was police involvement that sort of kicked it off. You know, in 65, there was the police situation with the Fry brothers. An altercation ensues. People are pissed. In 92, we're dealing with Rodney King and people being pissed. But if you look at the film, you'll see it's not just a police stop, and it's not just Rodney King. It's all of these other things. And it's so easy for people to say, black people are angry about Rodney King. That's why they went crazy. But there's way more to it than that. And you're not dealing with people who aren't in control of their emotions. You know, if you look at 65, there was a town hall meeting where Martin Luther King was there, and he says, you know, he goes into his Martin Luther King thing, which is very powerful.
I've said all over America, and I come out to Watts to tell you today that no matter how your hair looks, no matter what your features are, no matter what color you are somebody.
And then he opens the floor up to people to speak their minds. And one guy says, listen, we know that rioting isn't the answer, but no one was listening to us.
You couldn't talk to anybody because there was nobody to talk to. You couldn't talk to the cops because they didn't want to talk to me. They wanted to beat my brains out, just like they've been doing all the time. And the only way it seems that we can ever get anybody at any time to listen to us is start a riot. We got sense enough to know that this is not the final answer, but it's a beginning. It's a beginning.
So in 65, you had the opportunity to listen to folks, to make some changes. And of course, money comes into the community, and you have these programs. But then all these things that are still happening today were happening then.
How do you think the anger from 65 made its way into popular culture?
Well, I just want to reframe it a little bit. I don't really see it as anger. It's like an extra finger. You know that the system of policing, it's just something that weighs on you. And I don't know if I can describe it as anger. It's just something that's in the back of your mind every single day. It might not be the most prominent thing. I don't think African Americans walk around in the streets all day of Los Angeles, even in 1965, thinking the cops are going to beat my ass. But it's in there. It's in the back of your mind, amongst other things, loving your family, going for a walk. And because it's in the back of your mind, it is present in the arts, right? And that was an important part of my film, too. I wanted people to see that throughout all this oppression, folks of color in the inner city in Los Angeles used poetry, music, fine art as a way to exercise these demons and to, ultimately, it's reporting. It's sharing their experience. This art, going back to what your question about this anger, it's not even anger. It's almost in the DNA. We've been programmed for so long to hate ourselves and also that we are less than, that it has seeped into the DNA. And that's what I wanted people to see in my film.
Do you think that we are headed for another 92, that 65 is repeated in 92 and will be repeated in, 2020?
I mean, that's why with my film, I wanted people, young people in particular, to see this. We've lost sight of history. And although there are systematic issues and many strikes against some of us, in order for us to overcome these issues, we have to fully study and understand our history. And once you understand your history, if you're still falling for the okey-doke, then there's a problem. Because at a certain point, then animal instincts have to kick in and your survival instincts have to kick in. And in the wild, if you don't have survival instincts, you're not going to make it.
What did the 92 riot mean in American history? And does it constrain people today? Do people look back at 92 and go, we still have a lot of problems, but let's not go back there?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are afraid to go back there. I think the big message is a lot of money was lost. Of course, lives were lost, but money was lost. So you have to strip that all away and just go back to the way people feel. Strip it all away and go back to human feelings. And humans, particularly African Americans, are still feeling the way they did today in 92, the way they did in 65, the way they did in 1865. And until America says these people are Americans, like I've been telling folks at the end of my film, this guy, Alex Alonzo, who's a professor and a gang expert, calls his son into frame. This is completely spontaneous, and says,
tell this gentleman what I taught you about when we get pulled over by the police. What should you do?
Put your hands up on the dashboard so the police don't think you have any weapons, or to show your hands.
And how old are you?
12.
I gotta tell a 12-year-old how to conduct himself when he interfaces with law enforcement, because I'm scared that if he acts silly and does something with his hands, they will kill him. They've already killed Tamir Rice, who was 12 years old. So I gotta teach him how to conduct himself, where to put his hands, how to behave, so that we can make it where? After the end of the day, where are we going?
Home.
Home.
Can you imagine a film wherein white Americans, a white dad and his cute little 12-year-old son, tell the camera what I told you to do when the cops pull us over? America would be outraged. But because we are not considered Americans, it is what it is, and things don't change.
Sasha Jenkins is producer and director of the documentary Burn, Mother, You Can Imagine the Rest, Burn, which is currently streaming on Showtime. I almost forgot, it's 9 years of The Takeaway as of today, and there's a huge list of people who made this show possible, big and small, from the beginning. Most of all, the commitment of Laura Walker right here at WNYC. But today, our team of producers is Isabel Angel, John Asante, Alexandra Boti, Oliver Lazarus, TJ Raphael, Dana Roberson, and Elizabeth Ross. Amber Hall is our planning editor. Ellen Frankman is our senior producer. David Gable is our administrative assistant. Our tech team includes Vince Fairchild and Jay Cowett, who have been here from the very beginning, as has Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent and fill-in host. Irva Guncha is the executive producer, and that's the last time you're going to hear their names for 9 more years. Just kidding. I'm John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening, for all your support, all of you, from the beginning. This is The Takeaway.
John?
Hello?
John Hockenberry.
Who is it?
It's your 3 a.m. wake-up call.
Who is it?
Is that Bob Edwards?
Yes, it is, John.
It's Bob...
Bob Edwards? Bob Edwards?
This is your big day, John.
Oh, my... It's 3 a.m.? I got
it's
the call.
3 a.m. on day one.
Day one? I guess the question is, am I ready on day one?
Yes.
We're ready. It's The Takeaway.